Good morning and welcome to Saturday morning sessions for Sunstone Symposium 2008. This is session number 326. What's the title? Proclaiming the Family. Which family? Before we begin, I'd like to remind everyone to turn off any cell phones or pagers, any noise-making devices. Once the presenter and the respondent have completed their remarks, if you have any questions, please make your way to the microphone so that we can get it on the audio tape. This morning, we'll hear from H. Parker Blunt. He is Professor Emeritus, Educational Policy at Georgia State University. He's written a number of articles and presentations for Sunstone, including Scarlet Threads and the Lineage of Jesus, The God of Nature Suffers, and A Place Called Little Utah. He was also one of our 2005 Pillars of My Faith speakers. He's an avid gardener, and he currently is building and living in a cabin on the Ahoopee River in South Georgia. He's the father of six children. Following his paper, J. Frederick Toby Pingree will be the respondent. He is a member of the Sunstone Board of Directors, former chair of the board for Sunstone, a longtime participant and supporter of our community. He's a CPA. He's also a former bishop three times, a former mission president, and he and his wife have six children and nine grandchildren.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to tell you that this essay that I'm about to present to you got up to about 7,500 words. I've learned from experience that the max is 6,000 words if you want to leave time for discussion, as I do. So I cut it back to 5,000 words. It was a painful experience killing all those little darlings, and the very best part of the paper, I might add. So I'm telling you this because there are some things here that aren't as well developed as I'd like for them to be, and some of the transitions are fairly abrupt, but I think I can offend enough of you that you'll generate some questions and discussions, and maybe we can bring out some points that I'm interested in. I'd like to begin by reading a scripture from Matthew. Please don't refer to your own scriptures as I read this. And in your journey, make proclamation saying, "The kingdom of heaven has come near. Cure the infirm, raise up the dead, cleanse those with skin disease, cast out demons." In the Mormon church, we take family seriously. There's probably no institution that is more preoccupied with family than the LDS church. In 1995, church leaders issued the document, "The Family, a Proclamation to the World." The document did what others have found difficult and defined marriage and family, as well as specifying the responsibility of father, provider, and mother, nurturer. The proclamation claimed, quote, that the disintegration of the family will bring upon individuals, community, and nations the calamities foretold by ancient and modern prophets, end quote. And it called upon citizens and governments to, quote, maintain and strengthen the family as the fundamental unit of government, end quote. Alas, the family is in trouble. Just this past general conference, Elder Russell M. Nelson reminded his listeners that, quote, throughout the world, the family is increasingly under attack, end quote. His use of the phrase "family under attack" did not originate with him, but one that has been embedded in church leaders' sermons and church publications for at least a quarter of a century. For example, Elder Hartman Rector, Jr., back in 1981, was convinced that not since the days of Noah's have families been under a more serious attack. President Howard W. Hunter, in his Bountiful Utah Temple dedication, reminded the Lord that the, quote, family unit is under attack, end quote. This is an age, Elder Arthur R. Bassett noted, when family values often come under attack. When asked why the family, a proclamation to the world, was written, the late President Hinckley said, quote, because the family is under attack. All across the world, families are falling apart, end quote. Well, what do the brethren mean by under attack? Are we talking about something physical meant to destroy, like the Japanese attacking Pearl Harbor? Or is it a verbal attack, intending to demean, like calling the LDS Church a cult. Who is doing the attacking, and what weapons are they using? Are all families under attack, or just certain families? And what is the intended outcome of these attacks on the family? It turns out that it is Satan who is attacking the family. Quote, "We know without question Lucifer is the enemy of the family," says Elder Russell Ballard. It is Satan who is masterminding what Elder Ballard calls a relentless assault on the family. Satan is smart enough to realize that the surest and most effective way, I'm quoting Elder Ballard, that the surest and most effective way to disrupt the Lord's work is to diminish the effectiveness of the family and the sanctity of the home. Satan does this by producing discord between parents who then neglect family home evening and proper gospel instruction of the children. Family prayer slides, as does temple attendance along with family scripture study. That's all it takes, says Elder Ballard, to retard the Lord's work. Elder L. Tom Perry says that Satan is masterminding the decay of the family and that Satan is out to destroy the family. Elder Perry's take is that Satan's target is the father. He says, quote, "Satan, in his carefully devised plan to destroy the family, seeks to diminish the role of fathers," end quote. Elder Nelson, on the other hand, sees the mother as Satan's targets. Quote, "Because mothers are essential to God's great plan of happiness, their sacred work is opposed by Satan, who would destroy the family and demean the worth of women," end quote. This, then, is the picture preached from the LDS pulpit. The family is under attack by Satan, who wishes to destroy, or to use the word of the proclamation, disintegrate the family. What I am hearing is that Satan wishes to eliminate families. Not some families, but all families. One of the ways he is doing this, according to Elder Ballard, is by redefining family in ways contrary to God's eternal plan for the happiness of his children. And that, according to Elder Ballard, is why the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve wrote the proclamation. Other proofs of Satan attacks on family include, quote, "adultery, divorce, cohabitation, child and spouse abuse, homosexuality, abortion, teen pregnancy, pornography, disobedient children, economic struggles, and increasing unwillingness among married couples to bear and rear children," end quote. I'll return to that statement later. When the proclamation declares that family is ordained of God, does it mean all family types or just a certain family type? The answer is just one family type, and that in spite of our own history. Until recently, the definition of family within the LDS Church has been pretty fluid. As that Utah cultural asset Robert Kirby says, quote, "After all, there was a time when the local version insisted that the ideal family was one home builder, 20 homemakers, and too many children to stuff in a wagon, never mind a quiver," end quote. The concept of celestial kingdom building that Joseph Smith introduced and practiced and passed along to Brigham Young is quite different from the eternal marriage concept of today's church. Even though it was considered ordained of God and essential for salvation, President Wilford Woodruff discontinued the celestial marriage program that included polygamy and which also allowed a married woman to be sealed for eternity to someone other than the man to whom she was legally and lawfully wedded. President Woodruff only allowed sealings to occur between husband and wife, in other words, eternal marriage as we know it today. He, President Woodruff, thereby redefined the LDS concept of family, which in today's church is known as the forever family. What does the forever family look like? In most respects, it seems to be modeled after the American middle class type popularized in the 1950s era television. It is important to keep in mind that the American middle class family type isn't the only family configuration in this country, and certainly varies considerably from what might be found in other countries. Aside from the number of children, LDS middle class family configuration and child rearing practices are nevertheless virtually indistinguishable from American families at large. This seems strange, though, considering that the American family type is at such odds with the implications of the forever family concept. For one thing, as Professor Brad Shore, director of the Emory University for Myth and Ritual in American Life, observes, the American family type is designed to self-destruct. From the moment a child is born, the parent begins the process of moving the child out of the home. For the boy, the LDS parent begins a missionary fund and perhaps a college fund. The girl is taught from an early age to anticipate having a husband and a home of her own. Parents are seen as child-rearing failures if their children do not leave home and begin a life independent of the parents. And children are seen as failures, or certainly not quite right, if they continue to live at home after their teen years. At some point, most parents will downsize, moving to a smaller dwelling since their day-to-day relationship with the children has changed and they no longer need the space to accommodate them. Based on the forever family model, you would expect to find several generations of Latter-day Saints living in the same home with a distant cousin or two thrown in for good measure. Clearly, the implication of eternal marriage are more consistent with the extended family than with the nuclear family. According to Elder Eyring, now President Eyring, when we are, quote, home again after death with our heavenly parents in that wonderful place, no longer only as sons and daughters, but also as husbands and wives, fathers and mothers, grandfathers and grandmothers, grandsons and granddaughters, bound together in a loving family, end quote. He might have added the adjective huge as well. In fact, he might have more accurately described us simply as one loving family at home with our heavenly parents. Elder Nate Nelson, in his April 2008 General Conference sermon, where he said families are under attack, cautioned, quote, "If families fail, many of our political, economic, and social systems will also fail," end quote. My response was that it would be a good thing if some of them failed. But then my superb Brigham Young University training kicked in, and I realized that often families fail as a result of inadequate and corrupt political and economic policies. As to social systems, families are a social system embedded in a larger social system. In short, the failure of families, that is, the stress placed upon families that causes cracks and perhaps collapse like a building in an earthquake, are often the results of political and economic decisions that impinge upon the social system or communities in which the families exist. For example, if the church, which itself is a social system, places extraordinarily high expectations upon families, then you will see the effects upon individuals, and that in turn will reverberate within the family. The proclamation states, quote, "Further, we warn that the disintegration of the family will bring upon individuals, communities, and nations the calamities foretold by ancient and modern prophets," end quote. It seems to me that the church would say that anything that results in the disintegration of a family is a calamity. And in fact, calamities, be they social, economic, or physical, whether it is a hurricane or a bomb, brings about the disintegration of many families. Somehow, it doesn't make sense for God to punish his children by disintegrating the families because too many families have been disintegrated. So is the family under attack? No, I don't believe there is an organized expedition with the goal of destroying or disintegrating family. I don't think it is possible. Relationships between humans will always exist, and the nature of those relationships will be the basis for defining family. And one single definition will never cover the nature of relationships. In Diane Setterfield's novel, The 13th Tale, the character Margaret says she doesn't have a story about her life. Quote from the novel, "Miss Winter placed the ribbon at her page and closed the book. Everybody has a story. It's like families. You might not know who they are, might have lost them, but they exist all the same. You might drift apart, or you might turn your back on them, but you can't say you haven't got them." If one pays attention, it would be easy to conclude that the church has slipped from valuing family to idolizing family. It has become our golden calf. If we may have become so focused upon a particular model of family that we have cast it as the ideal, thus marginalizing other models that don't match our ideal template. We also need to consider whether we have oversold the family at the expense of the individual. Are we clear in our doctrine? Is salvation an individual thing or a family thing? And we have to be particularly careful that our rhetoric about family hasn't become a substitute for doctrine. After all, the early brethren considered a one-man, one-woman marriage to be degenerate, unholy, and against the order of God. When church leaders lament that the family is under attack, they often mean that their concept of marriage is under attack. The conflating of marriage and family can easily be seen in the church resistance to same-sex marriage. In the eyes of the brethren, allowing same-sex couples to have a ceremony producing them married will somehow contribute to the weakening or eliminating or disintegrating of family. In the current LDS worldview, the family comes into existence when a man and a woman marry and subsequently engage in multiplying and replenishing the earth. That, then, is the default version of the family, the one ordained of God, to be perpetuated beyond the grave. Let me step into the abyss and say that it isn't at all clear to me that God has ordained a particular family type. As far as I can tell, God didn't define family in the Old Testament, New Testament, or Book of Mormon, and the type he sort of defined in modern Revelation isn't the type the church endorses today. What Jesus says about family is this, quote, "There came then his brethren and his mother, and standing without, sent unto him, calling him. And the multitude sat about him, and they said unto him, Behold, thy mother and thy brethren without seek for thee. And he answered them, saying, Who is my mother or my brethren? And he looked around about on them which sat about him, and said, Behold, my mother and my brethren. For whosoever shall do the will of God, the same is my brother and my sister and my mother." While Jesus spent much of his ministry speaking for justice on this side of eternity, the brethren, like many religious leaders of all denominations, seem to be preoccupied with the exactness required to achieve the other side of eternity. In this case, the brethren are working with the current interpretation of Joseph's vision that the exalted sphere, the celestial kingdom. In that place, sometimes in a yet unannounced future, exalted couples will bring forth spirit children whose destiny is to obtain physical bodies and inhabit worlds created for them by their heavenly parents. Therefore, from this vantage point, gender-appropriate marriage is this temporal realm is not only mandatory, but anything less than marriage between a man and a woman as the basis of family is seen as a mockery of God, of God's ordained plan. Unfortunately, that view seems to produce more joy in the abstract than in the world I know. Even though the proclamation calls the family the fundamental unit of society, it is the individual who is the basic unit of society. The family is the basic community in the hierarchy of communities and society. Families are not some aberration of Siamese twins where everyone is physiologically connected and every member of the family is to look alike and think alike. The family is a unit where individual talents are developed and where the individual is not only allowed but encouraged to explore his or her individuality. In 1971, the first presidency with Joseph Fielding Smith as president issued a statement that gets at the relationship between family and the individual. Quote, "The forces of evil attack the individual by tearing away at his family roots. There may possibly be a few very strong individuals who can survive without the support of a family, but more of us need the love, teaching, and acceptance that comes from those who deeply care." End quote. As that era's first presidency acknowledged, the family's role is to support and strengthen the individual. And while the family as a social system is vulnerable, it is how the stress on the family affects the individual that is the great concern. Why do I not believe the family is under attack? While I do not believe the family is under attack, I do believe there is an eddy of madness encircling our world. That madness, like a creeping viper, wounds us. Those wounds affect the nature of all our interpersonal relationships within the family and between families. Yet, I am going to turn right around and use the family under attack language. But I'm going to talk about it within the context of relationships, the relationships between individuals, families, and communities. When we were children, we sang, "Froggy went a-courtin' and he did ride." These days, Froggy is riding right off into the dark night of oblivion. It appears that a third to half of the frog species have become extinct, or they are on the verge of extinction. Scientists are alarmed at this devastation occurring in the frog families of the world. However, not one of them, as far as I can determine, has blamed it on Satan. Instead, they say such things as amphibians are severely affected by habitat loss, climate change, pollution and pesticides, introduced species, and overcollection for food and pets, end quote. Many of the factors that are stressing frogs, frog by frog and frog family by frog family, leading to extinction, are affecting humans, person by person, family by family, community by community. Satan indeed may be the culprit, but we will do better if we can identify his agents and the sources of stress on the family. It appears to me that Satan, like the Lord, speaks and works through men and women. Just as we often do the Lord's work, fulfilling his purpose, unawares, consider Joseph sold into Egypt, we can also aid Satan unawares. That is, the Lord's work is not always done by good people, and Satan's by evil people. For example, Jesus commended Peter on many occasions, but on one occasion he condemned Peter, even calling him Satan. I believe that the viper is seen most clearly in economic practices. I believe that every time a family business is closes due to the unfair competition of mega corporations, a family is endangered. I believe every time a family farm is lost to agribusiness, families suffer. As a nation becomes more urban and directed by monolithic corporations, the small towns and communities suffer. Businesses close and the town dwindles. As they suffer, so do the families of those communities. The face of America changes and values shift as our lives are controlled by big business and government's preferential treatments of megacorporations. These are the forces that pull first at individuals, affecting his or her relationship with others, which ends up stretching many families to the breaking point. Susan Griffin, writing in the magazine Orion, says, quote, "Families are either supported or destroyed by the social and natural environments around them," end quote. She reviewed the documentary Darwin's Nightmare, which, quote, "shows how the destruction of Lake Victoria's ecology by the experimental introduction of predator perch, which proceeded to eat all other fish, has resulted in the dissolution of the lives of those who have lived around the lake for generations. As fishermen are dying or abandoning their families in great number, women turn to prostitution to feed their children. And as these women die of AIDS in great numbers, the gangs of homeless orphans live around the lake grow." Quote, the film gives us a harrowing glimpse into what superpower technocracies are doing to places and people all over the world. At Lake Victoria, the connection to militarism is not abstract. Following a common trend, the perch from the lake are not eaten locally. Instead, they are processed, frozen, and then flown to the Ukraine. But the plot thickens. The planes that take the food away do not arrive empty. They are filled with weapons that will be used in other regions in Africa, where bloody conflicts, including genocide, are occurring on an incomprehensible scale. End quote. Since I haven't seen the documentary Darwin's Nightmare, I can't attest to Ms. Griffin's summary, nor do I know that the documentary is balanced and fair in regard to what is happening at Lake Victoria. Even if it isn't, Griffin is on target when she calls our attention to, quote, "what superpower technocracies are doing to places and people all over the world," end quote. What they're doing to individuals, they're doing to the individual's family relationship. If you wish to consider the literal disintegration of families, then let's talk about war. Hafez Zangrana reports in her book, City of Widows, that in Iraq, 90 or more women daily become widows. She says, "The Ministry of Women's Affairs says that there are at least 300,000 widows in Baghdad alone, and a further 1 million throughout the country, and that the numbers are rising daily as men continue to disappear. Families are left without support. Widows have few resources at their disposal," end quote. End quote. That is only one aspect of the war that lays families to waste. But let's not talk about war and how it squeezes the life out of families. Let's talk about something sweeter, like bananas. Why do you suppose those wonderful yellow bananas shipped from Central America and elsewhere, so useful for making banana nut bread to be shared with non-member neighbors, generally cost less than locally grown apples? In the tale of what has become America's favorite fruit, the plot contains, you can be certain, greed and exploitation. Here is one small chapter in the story. In 1993, the European Union implemented a quota system giving preference to small banana farmers in the Caribbean in an effort to provide economic support to the communities and islands, helping them emerge from poverty. In other words, politics designed to strengthen families. Chiquita found its European sales slipping, so they went directly to the Clinton administration, which protested that the, quote, European regulations were both unfair and illegal under World Trade Organization rules, a case of government policy mandating preferential treatment to specific companies in what was supposed to be an open market, end quote. Raising bananas is the primary source of income for the small farmers of the island. Even though Chiquita controls some 50% of the banana market in Europe and the small farmers 8%, Chiquita essentially wanted to eliminate them from the market. Quote, I really do not see why it is in the interest of the United States that poor countries in the Caribbean and elsewhere, which are not able to do anything other than grow bananas, should be driven into more dangerous economic activity, such as drug trafficking, commented EU Trade Commissioner Sir Leon Brittan. Finally, in 2001, the Bush administration was satisfied with the concessions made by the European Union, and they lifted the $191 million worth of trade sanctions the United States had imposed on the European Union. Who suffered from all of this? Not U.S. farmers, not U.S. merchants who sell bananas, not U.S. consumers of bananas, and certainly not the CEOs whose compensation package was near $5 million. The victims were the small farmers and their families in the Caribbean. That is only one small chapter in the banana story. The other chapters include the exploitation of people and lands in Central America, with the U.S. government heavily involved in making sure American-owned fruit companies got their way, unfortunately at the expense of the local people. At this point, I am wondering if the proclamation includes the families of Lake Victoria, the Caribbean, and Central America as families under attack. Does it include the cotton farmers in America who are put out of business by the heavily subsidized American cotton agribusiness? Does it include the ruthless exploitation of the small cocoa farmers? Or does it care a whit about the little coffee farmer who suffers at the hand of the great companies? When the proclamation calls for governments to support the families, does it have in mind that question Rebecca Solnit asked, quote, what economic model explains 100-foot yachts and fifth homes U.S. captains of industries accumulates while hunger, homelessness, lack of access to medical care, and general precariousness overtake more and more of the population, end quote. Church leaders thought it important that members study and use the proclamation. Consequently, a series was published for that purpose. The following statement is taken from one of those guides. Quote, the family, the most fundamental institution in society, is under attack from all sides. Adultery, divorce, cohabitation, child and spousal abuse, homosexuality, abortion, teen pregnancies, pornography, disobedient children, economic struggles, and increasing unwillingness among marriage couples to bear and rear children. All these and more are proof that the adversary understands very well the central role the family plays in the destiny of God's children. End quote. Do we really not see that economic struggles can fuel divorce, cohabitation, abuse, abortion, and almost everything else on the list of proofs of the adversary's attack on families? I understand that in the church, economic struggle is a code word for irresponsible money management. But there is a world of people whose economic struggles have nothing to do with personal mismanagement. It has everything to do with exploitation and injustice, leaving desperate individuals and disintegrating families. Warner Woodruff, professor of organizational behavior at Brigham Young University, states on his website that the first presidents of the LDS Church is concerned with, quote, growing inequality between rich and poor, exorbitant corporate profits, unethical executives, and, as President Spencer W. Kimball put it, the need for business owners to not pay as little as they can get away with, but to pay top dollar to one's employees, end quote. I have missed those talks where the brethren expressed their concern. I wish they expressed them more frequently and with the same intensity and forthrightness as Professor Woodruff, who says, in spite of our professed religious and ethical values, BYU is about the last university in the country to hold a globalization symposium for raising awareness of multinational corporation abuses, exploitation of third world workers, unsafe working conditions, child abuse, etc., end quote. Warner speaks openly and publicly about the tyranny multinational corporations wield through their excessive power. He speaks out against the sweatshops the exploitation of labor, third world debt, and unequal societies. He speaks about the increase in poverty, which he correlates with growing globalization, where billions of people live on less than $2 a day. These are the very practice evils, if you will, which contribute to disintegration of families. Unfortunately, many of these practices are supported by our government and elected officials. If the church is going to call upon governments to support and maintain families, maybe they should also be bold enough to point out those things that the governments do that weaken families. Aren't we embarrassed to say that in the last 50 years there have only been two political issues with moral consequences that the church felt the need to speak out against? As Marcus Borg has said in his book, The Heart of Christianity, quote, "We're all called to be political in the broad sense of being aware of the impact of systems on people's lives and God's passions for those who are disadvantaged and victimized by systems," end quote. All right, we Mormons have proclaimed to the world how important the family is. Are we prepared to listen to the Catholic who says, quote, "Okay, you're for the family. What do you do about it?" If we have a whole bunch of young men who've grown up in broken families and violent neighborhoods and end up in prison, how is that going to help strengthen the family? There's a moral basis for healthy family, but there's also an economic base for the healthy family. The question to debate is whether conservative policies strengthen or undermine the family, end quote. And then there's the Reverend Jim Wallace who says, when will we understand that goals such as universal health care, affordable housing, and living wage incomes are pro-marriage and family programs, end quote. I would also add the voice of novelist, poet, professor, and farmer Wendell Berry, quote, "The most forceful context of every habit now is the industrial economy that is doing damage to all habitats. We can't preserve neighborhoods, our charity, our peaceability, or an ecological consciousness, or anything else worth preserving at the same time that we maintain an earth-destroying economy. Nothing ultimately flourishes in our present economy but selfish aims, and those are often mutually contradictory. We have to have a sort of pity for those who are sure that it takes a village to raise a child, but who forget that it takes a local culture and a local economy to raise a village." Tracy Kidder, in his powerful biography of the medical doctor Paul Farmer, who has spent much of his life in Haiti establishing and running a medical clinic, included this paragraph in the biography. "Now the United States was leading a concerted effort to block aid to Haiti's government, not just American aid, but all grants and loans from other sources, including loans from an international agency that would have financed an increase in the supply of potable water, an improvement in roads, education, and public health system. The stated reasons probably included long-standing institutional fear and distrust of Aristide, a hope that Haitians might blame him for the country's continuing decline and general weariness with Haiti's problems. Farmer wrote to me about the block loans," and this is what Paul Farmer said, "I think sometimes that I'm going nuts, that perhaps there is something good about blocking clean water for those who have none, making sure that illiterate children remain so, and preventing the resuscitation of the public health sector in the country most need of it." And then he added, "Lunacy is what it is." Who will tell the truth about those systems that are tearing families apart? Who will speak for justice? We should take a note from our own book that says a moderate-sized congregation where everyone is known and involved is more effective than a megachurch, and began to actively oppose anything that causes the disintegration of the village. A local economy keeps the evil of greed and exploitation at bay, whereas a global economy seems to maximize it. Rather than family, perhaps we should proclaim community. On the other hand, it seems more important to proclaim people, person by person. But then that proclamation already exists, doesn't it? "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He hath sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, and recovering the sight to the blind, and set at liberty them that are bruised." Thank you.
My comments will be more by way of, I think, a reaffirmation of what Parker said rather than any kind of a critique. I'm delighted to be on the program with him. As Troy mentioned at first, he's prepared some papers for Sunstone that have been in other places. The dialogue has been very good. I don't think Troy mentioned is what I read was impressive. That Scarlet Thread, what, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah. Which I thought dealt with the approach the church has taken toward trying to get all the young men and young women in the church into moral status, basically, and compared to that to how some of the perhaps fallen women in the Bible have been treated, and it was a very, very interesting comparison to make and about how we do things. And I think today he's doing the same thing here. He's taking on a sacred cow. We have the proclamation and the family and so on, and suggesting that, while maybe the end is, the objectives are not bad, the way we're going about it is very destructive. I'll proceed on there. As Mormons, we have heard and read about a lot about an institution that has become virtually deified in our meetings, publications, discourse, and lesson materials. In Parker's presentation, he has taken on the campaign the church has waged for years to burnish the family image in our hearts and minds. He doesn't dispute the importance of the family in today's world nor the role it should play in the church, but he does challenge many of the assumptions the church makes about the family and the limited breadth of the campaign. For starters, he points out that the family gold standard has one man and one woman, with emphasis on one. The measure intentionally serves to preclude same-sex unions, but also includes what was the highest Mormon gold standard of the late 19th century of one patriarch and a bevy of helpmeets. There may be considerable confusion thereafter when the leaders of the modern church are confronted by the first-generation Mormon hierarchy and they compare their pronouncements on the matter. We shouldn't be surprised if some of the current church leaders show up at the pearly gates to be greeted by the one and only who preceded them to the celestial kingdom, and now have to resolve how they're going to integrate the second wife into the one-woman model of marriage. Furthermore, the 1+1 formula has other consequences beyond distancing the church from those forms of family not tolerated in the church. The majority, I believe, of church members today live in families without one man and one woman present. Death and divorce have resulted in many of these single-parent households, and the church rhetoric makes many who are struggling in these circumstances feel further marginalized. Holding out the one-on-one model as a standard hits its intended targets of post-manifesto polygamy and gay marriage, but inflicts friendly fire on a family headed by a single adult that brings unintended negative consequences. Parker spends the majority of his paper on reviewing the things that are said to be a threat to the existence and stability of the family. He agrees that there are forces at work in society that make family life difficult, but he believes that giving Lucifer all the credit causes us to miss the major sources of family stress. We are told that the weapons of war successfully employed by Satan against the family include adultery, divorce, cohabitation, sexual and spouse abuse, homosexuality, abortion, teen pregnancies, pornography, disobedient children, economic struggles, and increasing unwillingness among married couples to bear and rear children. He went through that twice in the paper. Very important, man. While these factors can impact families to varying degrees, Parker rightly points out that the major challenges to successful family life or circumstances that make making a living so difficult for a majority of the world's population. Things such as inadequate or unavailable health care, limited or absent schooling opportunities, unequal and unjust social circumstances, along with the economic struggles listed in Satan's tools, are far more devastating to the world's families, particularly in developing countries, than are the largely personal choices and lifestyle issues that make up the laundry list of the devil's implements. Lacking food for one's children or basic women's prenatal health care are problems immensely more destructive than having a gay couple of children living next door. The church deserves credit for addressing some of these issues in its humanitarian outreach programs. responding to natural disasters with food, shelter, and clothing, providing wheelchairs for the disabled, school supplies for those with none, and sending medical teams to the backward areas of the world are all worthy activities that certainly enhance family strength and stability. But there is so much more that could be done. The energy, political, and moral capital and resources now devoted to reshaping state political life could have a profound impact for good if directed toward the real problems. Shifting to another sector, just briefly about Parker's paper, I liked his addressing the purely doctrinal aspect of the family, which is of what it will be like in the hereafter. For years, I've struggled trying to make sense out of how we can all be bound together forever in loving families. The first thought that came to mind was that I and my wife will have the joy of being bound with our children and having the same kind of joyful experience we had in raising them. However, that runs into some conflicts I haven't resolved. As my children marry and then they have their own families, I would want to be united with them. And I suspect that my parents would want to have me and my siblings under their wings, as my in-laws would want my wife and other children to be with them. The combinations are endless, and I can't fathom how you can band them together forever in loving families. I think the more workable model, and even the only workable model, is to accept the fact that we're going to essentially be couples in the identity. My wife and I are separated from our parents and our children from us, so that leaves us to make it as eternal companions. We will have plenty of company following the gold standard of heavenly marriage, but I'm not sure how those with multiple spouses can all fit into the one and one model for eternity. Anyway, that's sort of how I feel about the paper. Parker, I thought it was a good job, I look forward to you continuing to provoke us with ideas of the gore of the sacred cows of Mormonism. Thanks.
If anybody has any questions, again, please come to the microphone. But to begin with, let's talk about the politics of these issues. How political should the institution be, and how political should the membership be in trying to address the threats to the family that you highlighted?
I told him to ask that question. I wanted to get into politics a little more because I firmly believe, as I quoted Marcus Borg, that anytime we're concerned with families, there are political issues everywhere and you just can't ignore them. I would like to see the church be less partisan. You know, the church takes a position that it's politically neutral except on these select moral issues. But in fact, the church is incredibly partisan. You know, I don't know how they've done it, but almost all of us are Republican and conservative. In fact, I can reveal, Toby wrote me an email and he said, you know, I've been Republican almost all my life and voted that way, but now I'm quite discontent with it. Well, that's the same with me. You know, I just registered as a Democrat the other day. But there's this kind of underground stream of partisan politics in the church, and that's frightening to me. And I really want the church to come out and be less underground partisan and openly political in the sense of caring and addressing moral issues that affect all of us that I've talked about. So that's my spiel on that. Thank you.
Undercurrent without actually getting into the fight, in the sense that it has aligned its moral views of the family with those of the religious right, which forms part of the coalition that has kept these conservative policies and politicians in place.
Thank you. I agree with that. I might add it to my paper. Hardy.
came here, I mean, I remember the last time I attended one of your things, and I made a disagreement with you a little bit.
Yeah, you went away mad.
And so I came here to kind of a peacekeeping move, but unfortunately, I actually let me ask a series of questions that you can respond to. What I'm worried about is you're saying that the failure in families, I almost get the feeling, is due to the stresses that come from outside.
Yes.
I may miss that, but let me ask the following questions. Is it possible for families, or say fathers and mothers, husbands and wives, to react to stresses in positive ways? Are there ways that they can cope with those things that don't destroy the family? Why do some survive these economic difficulties and their families and their relationships are strengthened by the stress rather than torn apart by it? On the other hand, why is it that the couple that live across the street from my daughter, who have a big house and a lot of wealth, have divorced? Just finally, the final question sums these all up. Why do we keep blaming the outside when it may be as much a failure of the individual, husband, wife, to live the gospel of Jesus Christ?
You ask a number of questions, some of them perennial questions, and I would like to respond in multiple ways. I'm going to say this simply. First of all, a broken family does not always produce broken people, just as a wholesome family does not always produce whole people. There are such things as victim in the world. There are some people that are clearly and simply victims, and that's all there is to it. And nothing that they could do would change that. Some people victimize themselves. There was a time in my life when I sat on the stand and looked at thousands of people at state conference and said, these are the most wonderful people in the world, but every problem that exists in the world can be found right out here. And some of these people go out of their way to have problems. And so I don't have clean answers for you, but I do believe this, Hardy. To simply say, if everybody had lived the gospel, everything would be dandy. That's nonsense. You know, that's just, and I hear, well, I'm not even going to get into that. But you were kind and generous this time, Hardy, and I love you for it.
Hello, I'm Ola Thomas. I'm with Affirmation Gay Lesbian Mormons. And, of course, one of the threats of the family that's mentioned frequently is homosexuality. And, obviously, I would enjoy the opportunity to marry, or my friends, I'm sure they would. And I've read as much as I can of the talk about strengthening the family, defending the family, and I've even been to day-long conferences sponsored by the church for defending the marriage, and they keep saying prevent gay marriage is a way to defend marriage, but I've never seen the explanation or any reason within what exactly about preventing same-sex marriage strengthens or defends the family. I'm not quite sure, and I thought maybe perhaps you more exposure that you could elaborate more. What exactly does the church feel is the threat of a same-sex marriage?
Yeah.
I know.
All right. Speak. But you're limited to 2 minutes.
The threat is that they might actually be happy and well-adjusted and thus show the weakness in the Mormon attitude toward their family. I am lucky to be an honorary auntie to a family that includes 3 daddies, 2 mommies, 2 children, 2 gay men, 3 gay men, and 2 lesbians, and the children. They're so well-adjusted. They're happy. The fear of gay marriage is that if you let these people do what they want, they'll prove that you can live happily without the church.
So I really appreciated your paper, and the thing that I would like to know is what are some ways that could effectively raise awareness about this, because my brother and sister-in-law just moved, and the first thing that they looked for is how close will we be to Costco and Walmart. And I don't know, it's like we're just, it's like Walmart is a new god. But like the big corporations, the technocracies, that what it was. How do we, because there's so much resistance against these ideas, how do we raise awareness in a way that people that are really resistant might change their minds a little?
I there are probably a multitude of ways. I thought it was interesting as I read in the Salt Lake Tribune here in a couple of different instances where local governments completely supported Walmart, for example, in opposite community totally opposed to them building the Walmart at that location, but local government supported them, but it was not an issue for the church. And it seems to me it should have been, but all I'm calling for, which of course no one will pay any attention to, is for the brethren to move beyond saying the family is under attack and that Satan's doing it, and start addressing some of the issues. And if they really want to strengthen the family, move beyond the church and look at it in a much broader perspective. That's my call, which, as I say, I know that no one's going to respond to that, but makes me feel good to say it. But I think you have to get engaged in private kinds of activities, whatever it is, whatever local kinds of activities are going on, and do your thing there.
Well, you just actually raised the issue that I wanted to ask about, and I want to say how grateful I am to you, Parker. This is why I come to Sunstone. This was wonderful. I was so happy to hear you place Mormonism in a global context, in a larger context. It's not just us talking about, wow, what are our bad issues and what do we have to fix? It's how do we deal with the rest of the world? How can we impact the rest of the world? And I would like to suggest to the members of the board who are here that at some point there be an entire Sunstone symposium devoted to not just Mormonism and politics, but Mormonism and activism beyond Mitt Romney, ERA, and gay marriage. How do we address these larger issues? You just talked about activities. What do you suggest for activism? What do we do?
Registers a Democrat?
My parents were more upset when I left the Republican Party than when I left the church, but I did that a lot.
So I have a slight bias towards same-sex marriage because I'm gay myself. It seems I equate same-sex marriage with blacks and the priesthood with regards to the church. It's a social issue that eventually the church is going to get boxed in on politically, culturally, in many aspects, and they're going to have to ultimately change their position. With a document like a proclamation to the world that is so set in stone and so ironclad in its definition, how do you think the church will deal with that document when that time happens?
I think that at some point down the road, someone will say something like, these brethren only express their opinion, and we, the living prophets, determine what doctrine is, just as they have recently done. So that's how it will be handled, at some point.
Same-sex marriage threatens the church because it runs counter to the patriarchal family. You cannot have a patriarchal family unless there's a man at the head.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And I briefly said that in my paper, that they have this vision of the exalted family, and that's what has to predominate here.
Do we need to include
Are there any other questions? Toby, oh, yes.
Well, it isn't really a question. It's a piece of good news.
Good.
About this whole thing. I have the experience of teaching college students all over the Salt Lake, Provo, Ogden area. And classes like critical thinking, and a lot of times these issues come up, and it's been about 6 years now since I've been doing that. And I've noticed that the argument that the church offers, which is that the family will be destroyed if we allow same-sex marriage, it doesn't seem to be working. That that arguments have a kind of a life if they have legs, you know, if they sort of resonate with people. And what I've found over the 6 years is that the argument doesn't resonate with a lot of LDS people. 75% of my students are LDS. And that argument is slowly slipping off the roof. And it's really good to see it go. But if the longer the church issues that argument, the less its credibility grows. Because when you are an institution that issues an unpersuasive argument, you lose credibility. And so they're actually doing a good thing in the end.
Yeah. Thank you. Toby, you. Yeah.
The question raised about what can we do in this in the economic arena, I've done precious little. I've done virtually nothing. But there have been some success stories in terms of with Nike. And people going to the Far East and seeing the conditions and working conditions in the factories over there and saying, you know, you got your 12-year-old kids working 12-hour days or whatever it is. And Nike has changed. And for those of you, who drink coffee, why have you withheld your coffee from buying from Starbucks? Why, Starbucks changed too and is now buying more coffee from small farmers. They pledged to do certain things like that. And that's... I think the banana thing is there's no excuse for that. That is terrible, and I don't think he's been correct with it either. But get involved in those kind of things. I think that's one way.
Okay, we are out of time. I'd like to thank again Parker and Toby for their presentations today. Thank you.